Loyal listeners of Tectonic will know that one of the research topics on the TSIA research agenda is how technology companies are leveraging AI to improve the workflows related to revenue generation. As part of that research, we have been looking for revenue leaders that have both experience and vision on how AI can change their organizations. Well, I found one of those folks, and I invited them to be a guest on Tectonic. I'm Thomas Law, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. Today, I will be speaking with Mike Fouts, who is the Chief Business Officer at ShareFile, and we will be discussing the future of revenue management within tech companies. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Welcome, Mike. It's great to see you again. This is the second time you and I have met. So can you introduce ShareFile to the audience, explain your role there?
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for having me. It's really great to be here. ShareFile, I'm excited. We celebrate our 20th birthday next year.
Wow.
So 20 years. And what we do for a living is secure sharing, collaboration, e-signature, and vertically focused workflows. And my role, as you mentioned, I'm the Chief Business Officer. So what that means is I'm responsible for our global sales, marketing, and our go-to-market functions.
Okay. Because Chief Business Officer, so I see Chief Revenue Officer, I see Chief Customer Officer. I don't often see Chief Business Officer. I'm just curious, why'd you land on that term as opposed to like CRO?
It's just a little bit broader. One of our goals was to really put in the functions into the role, which encompassed everything necessary to be successful in going out and driving all the revenue in the organization. So we have myself, we have a Chief Product Officer. He owns all of our product and development and engineering. And then we have a COO. She owns all of the operational pieces. So we tried to keep it pretty simple and give each of us everything that we needed to run the business.
Does the COO have then the service, like the post-sales delivery functions? Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Post-sales as well as customer success.
Yep. So, Mike, I think you're really a CRO. Anyway, we just wanted to, for the audience, to clarify what you're doing for a living. So I, you know, recruited you to be on Tectonic because the first time we met, we had this great discussion on how the sales function within technology companies is changing. Starting with how they need to become more data driven. And, you know, our last book, we had a whole chapter on data driven sales organizations. So tell me about your journey in leveraging data to predict renewal revenues, because I think that's one of the first places you started.
Yeah, I think it's been pretty interesting. So just to level set, we transformed our go-to-market to a vertical-based sales motion. We did that entirely based on the data. Mm-hmm. So a couple of examples for the listeners. 71% of our business is a sub-50 user company. So it's in that smaller space, right? Our average customer tenure is just over 6 years. So we have pretty good retention as a result. So that led us on this journey to use data to better understand what and how our customers use our solutions, and then how we can meet those customers where they are and best serve them. So what that meant was it really changed our entire go-to-market strategy. We transformed to a low and no-touch e-commerce motion. We changed our marketing strategy. We were fairly traditional where we drove demand exclusively to a salesperson, to a human being and a seller. Now we're driving that to this low or no-touch e-commerce motion. So just completely transformed how we build the top of the funnel and bring our customers in to the journey with ShareFile.
And so let me click into a couple of the things. So one, on verticalizing. So you looked at the data, and how many verticals do you guys support?
We support four primary verticals, and then we have sub-verticals below them.
And so within those verticals, you see, you know, common patterns in terms of how they're using the technology, et cetera. So you can customize sort of the sales approach to those those verticals. And I want to get a sense of like how deep you went there, because a lot of technology companies do what we call the thin vertical veneer, where they're like, oh yeah, go to our website and like, yeah, like we totally get healthcare companies, but you know, if you click underneath that, they really don't. So put a little meat on the bone about as you verticalized on the go-to-market side, what additional work were you doing there to be successful within verticals?
Yeah, happy to. So let me set up here. We did our four primary verticals are what we call business services. So underneath that are some verticals like accounting, legal, professional services. Then we have financial services, pretty descriptive, right? Wealth management, banks, insurance. We have government, education, healthcare. That's the third vertical. Mm-hmm. And then we have this fourth vertical we call industrial services. It's a little bit of everything else, but primarily it's real estate, manufacturing, and construction.
Okay, that's interesting.
And,
yeah.
And so we divided the sales teams up into those verticals to kick off our year. We did enablement with them. So if you're a seller in the legal sub-vertical, you have a subset of legal customers, and we train them all the way down the stack. So here's the trends in that industry. Here's the language that they use. Here's the problems. Here's the buyer personas. Mm-hmm. Here's who you're going to talk to. Here's who you're going to compete against. We really built a sales motion into that vertical. We also have released products specifically designed for those verticals. We just 2 weeks ago released a product designed for accountants who deal with taxes. So they have a specific product that has workflows that run start to finish for tax returns, federal and state. So we married up our go-to-market motion with our product motion.
I just wanted you to explain that because, again, we believe deeply that a lot of tech companies are going to have to verticalize. Historically, they've been very horizontal with their technology capabilities. But if you want to keep differentiation in, if you want to be value add to the customer, you really do have to understand their workflows more intimately. So just like you were describing, hey, if we're really going to go in and understand how accountants are doing using our technology versus somebody else, and then let's click into having customers a more digital experience. And it sounds like the very sort of front end of that sales cycle, when they're getting to know who you are, getting to understand your capabilities, that instead of that being a salesperson who's holding their hand or walking them through that, you want that to be a more digital experience. Is that the objective?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's really our land motion, right? So we want to acquire the customer through that motion. And there's various examples that we can give. But what we want them to do is to be able to come in, and if they want to try our software, they can try it, right? Yep. That's fully self-serve. They can easily convert to a purchase. So it's a try and buy, and they can run that motion all on their own. Yeah. We do offer light touch, right? So if you're in that motion and you say you're a customer, you want to ask a question or you want to clarify, you can immediately get connected to a seller who will help you with that. But the reality is what we've seen so far, 95%+ is all done with no touch.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, when I'm in this conversation about a digital first sales motion, and especially having the customer really understand the product digitally before maybe they're making larger purchase, and you also describe the fact that your customers, a lot of them are smaller, where's that inflection point when a customer, let's say they're in there, they're using a freemium, they want to buy, but maybe they're a large organization, or maybe they have more complex. What is that inflection point that you typically see where, okay, I do need to get a salesperson involved?
Yeah, it manifests itself in two ways. We do see larger customers, by the way, absolutely. Yeah. It's not exclusive to a small customer. And we watch through some of our machine learning and our AI, we watch for how many users they're testing and trying and how many users they're looking at.
Yeah.
We set a threshold. So if it's above that, we proactively reach out and say, hey, right, we're here. We also look for, when the customer comes in, we look to see who they are. And then we map that against an account list. And if they're in our larger account sizes, what we call the mid-market and up, we'll do light touch to make sure we understand.
Make sure they're doing okay.
That's right. And oftentimes you get, it's a department, and they go, hey, I want to try this out, but I'm really going to roll this out to a couple hundred users. We want to have some involvement in that. So.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think, and of course, there are people who say, look, our products are so complex, there is no concept of trying or whatever. And I get that. But I think for more and more products, the ability for customers to get on, to start to get some value, to understand, and then you can get sales involved, I think is going to be a winning approach for so many. But I want to go back to, actually, I'm going to recap here just quickly. Already, there are two things you have on the table that I think speak to the trends of where go-to-market is changing for tech. One is probably more vertical, more understanding. And the number two is more digital first to get the customer introduced. Sure. The other thing, back to data and using data to, you know, understand what's going on with the health of your revenues and starting with renewal revenues and renewal risk. How do you leverage data there?
So in a couple of ways. So what we did was we look at, and the phrase I use, Thomas, is I want to look around corners. I want to be able to see around the corner, right? So I want to see what the customer's doing and how they're doing it and what usage it is. And we've built some ideal customer profiles and some visibility into customers who have the highest propensity to both upgrade and expand, as well as the highest likelihood to churn. Mm-hmm. And so for those that have a likelihood to churn, there's a set of characteristics that we see. Yep. We go approach them and we try and reverse that trend, and we try and get in front of that before the renewal event with enough time to get them into a profile that continues to renew and retain for us.
And just to interrupt you there, give me a sense of how long ahead of that curve you're getting, right? So you're looking at the data and it's flashing and saying, this is a churn risk. Are you getting that warning 3 months before, 3 weeks before? I mean, how much advance warning are you getting, some signal liquidity around that, hey, we should be doing some interventions here?
Yeah. So most of our term agreements, most of our contracts are 1 year in length. Mm-hmm. We start that at the 6 month timeframe.
Okay.
So it gives us, really the renewal event. You really start talking about the renewal 90 days in advance. So at 6 months, we start ringing the bells, right? About, the health of this, what's it look like?
Yep.
That gives us enough time to go do something that drives a meaningful or different result.
Okay. And then let's talk a little bit about the intervention. So once the flag goes off, are there a standard set of intervention plays you find are successful? Do you get recommendations from the data that tells you, hey, based on what the data is telling us, it should be this specific intervention? How does that work?
Yeah, it's interesting. The biggest thing we look for that is a red flag, in all honesty, is what's the source? Mm-hmm. If we get stuck in the IT motion with the IT admin or the IT infrastructure side of the business, that's a problem for us because they look at it simply as an infrastructure tool. That's it, right? And so a lot of the value goes away. When we get to the line of business that's using it, that's where they see the value in the workflow and they understand how it helps their business and how it helps them be better with their clients and end user customers. Yep. That's the biggest line of demarcation we look for. If we're in that infrastructure, we got work to do because we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, interesting. And then, and how long have you been using the data to predict renewal, churn and also, expansion?
We started in 2023 with it, and it's an evolution, by the way. Yeah. You learn kind of what matters and what doesn't, and sometimes you think certain things matter and they really don't. But we started in 2023. I feel like we're a lot smarter this year in 2024, but it is, I can't stress enough, it's a constant evolution that you look at, and you don't ever get too married to something because market dynamics, customer dynamics, everything is fluid. So it's constantly moving.
So, and it's another conversation I'm in all the time because people want to know, like, gosh, if I start to lean into data specifically for this use case on renewals, how long is that journey? So once you said, hey, we're going to use data here to be our guide, and you started to chip on that, how long did it take before you started to get some meaningful results from the data? Was it like 3 months, 6 months? Because like you said, you're trying to look around corners. So how long before the data was helping you do that, do you think?
Yeah, I'll share our experience with it. What we like to do is, philosophically, we're a beta test, or we're an A-B test, right? So we'll put something out there, we'll test it, get some results. But then we had to take about a 60-day period and really be thoughtful about it. So I'll give you an example. We're no different than anybody else. We got a
lot of data floating around.
Yeah, right. It's everywhere, right? You got tons of it. What we struggled with and what we had to sit down and do is figure out what the heck matters, right? And I'm going to give you a baseball example. My son played all the way up through college baseball, played a high level. He was a pitcher. And I kind of broke it down that way. There's a core set of things you can look at to see if somebody's a good pitcher, right? How many innings do they pitch? How many strikeouts? How many hits? How many walks? That will frame up the core, right? Then you want to understand, okay, well, why do they strike people out or why do they give up hits? And you start looking at the advanced analytics below that. data in isolation is not valuable. So in that example, just because a pitcher has a high spin rate on his curveball, mm-hmm. who cares, right? Yep. What's that lead me to? So we had to be careful with that. We kind of got into that where we were looking at, hey, these little points.
Discrete variables instead of the whole, yeah.
That's right. That's right. You have to look at what are the metrics that matter, right? What are we trying to drive here? And we built that set. So what we learned was that we paused and took about 60 days. So in total, it took us about 6 months to get where mm-hmm. we wanted to be with what we thought
with the model.
Yeah.
So let's click into that because, you know, we did an episode with Reef AI, their CEO, and they do machine learning models for renewal propensity. So there's a difference here. When people start out and they start saying, gosh, I'm trying to understand predict renewals, they start out usually with what we'll call predictive analytics, where you're picking variables and you're kind of testing. Does that variable, or like you just said, that set of variables working kind of together, does that move the needle or not? And so that's way better than basically just, you know, asking the salesperson or whatever, is this going to renew? So you're making a huge step forward there, right? But then the next click over is feeding the data, right? Like you said, everybody's got lots of data. Feeding the data into a machine learning model that you, in the first cut of the model, you say, well, we think it's these six variables, right? Yeah. Test that. But as the model keeps churning and chunking on this thing and getting more data, it's going to start to identify for you maybe variables you didn't understand. So did you get to that point in a machine learning model or are you? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did. And we used that to largely, and I'll say probably 75% of the way, guide our quotas. We pay our reps on both new business and renewals. We use that modeling to guide our quota assignment and predict churn rates and renewal rates and everything. Now we did apply, we didn't trust it fully because it's, it was really still our first learning, year doing it, right? But we used it to really simplify that process. And so far at the mid-year, you know, we evaluated every quarter and look at all the metrics. It's been pretty accurate. We might have missed by about 2% between some things, but it's been pretty accurate so far.
Yeah. And so in my sense in this is that if you start to go through this journey, and again, we're just picking on this renewal case again, and again, you're somebody who's really living it, which is why I wanted to get you on, is you have direct experience with it. It's not theory to you. You're not like promoting an AI solution. You're like, hey, I'm a power user here. And so from your chair, I mean, if, again, you're as a chief business officer, you start and you go, I have no data models. I start to have, you know, some analytics models. Now I have a model that is continuing to learn. Can you imagine now trying to run your business without that? I mean, what would life be if you basically said, I have, you know, I have no data, I have no model, I got to go back to the old ways. I mean, that's got to be can't imagine.
It would be terrifying. I feel like I would run completely blind, right? Especially in a SaaS-based business where it's highly transactional, there's a tremendous amount of velocity and volume. You would just be hoping that stuff comes to the door, right? So we run the forecast. This is an interesting point. I think where you're going with this is, I kind of came up, I'm old enough that I came up with deal-based forecasts, right?
Yeah,
we sold
absolutely.
A product and a widget, you had a deal-based forecast and your QBR every quarter looked at, hey, these
are coming in, is it not coming in? Yeah.
Right. Right? What can I do to move it from Q3 to Q2, right?
That's right.
All that kind of stuff, right? QBR now is radically different. It's a model review, right? What are we looking at in the data? What's the model show? What can we inject or insert that will change that trajectory? Or what can we... So it's so different now. Yeah. And I don't know if I could go back.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I, you know, the reason I'm shining a light on this is, I mean, I just think about any buddy who's managing revenue, and it's not going to take long before, if you're not in the posture you are, which is, look, I've got a model driven QBR, it's data driven, I'm getting down to 1-2% error here. If you're not in that position, God, I mean, I don't know how you're managing your business.
Yeah,
that's what's going to happen.
I agree. Now, I will say this, right, for everybody out there listening, if you haven't done this yet, if you're not in the model, it's a transition, right? It's a way of thinking that there is a scary step, right?
Yep.
As you cross the bridge and get over, it is a little bit scary because you're kind of leaving behind, hey, I you know, for 20 years or more,
40 years,
I did it this way, right? And now I've got to put a little bit of trust in this. But once you get over the bridge on that, there's no turning back, right? It's it's just the only way to do it.
Yeah, no, I firmly believe that. And so let's go beyond renewal management, because the other thing you and I were talking the first time we met is we don't think that, you know, data and AI and analytics is going to impact just, you know, renewal management. Yeah. You know, it's really has the potential to change the way that a sales force works in all kind of different, you know, workflows. So where do you see some of the other potential for AI, for better, you know, leverage of data, et cetera?
Yeah. So, by the way, we're the same as probably everybody out there. So we see a few ways in there. One of the things that's really become evident as we bring customers into our e-com motion, once they come in, that's not a warm lead, right? We know something about them. They're doing something. We have an opportunity to expand and run a set of plays to expand out. That's probably been the biggest eye-opening area for me as we came into this year in this full model. And, you know, the sales team just inherently, I don't think they did anything. They just, it's because of the data and the model we switched to, they became much smarter about the customer, right?
Yeah.
Much smarter about what to talk to them about and what problems to solve and where to expand. So they really kind of walked into a little bit of a ready-made environment, right? All the stuff you used to have to do, you have to ask all these qualifying questions and go dig.
Through discovery,
If you missed a question, your discovery, you were out of luck, right? You missed an opportunity. We kind of provide that to them now, right? So this whole...
And you're saying because of the interaction that the customer's already having on the platform.
That's right.
And let me ask this. And because of what vertical they're in, I'm assuming that you've got insights because of that. You can marry those two things and serve that up on a silver platter to the salesperson.
That's
right. And say, so here's where we think the opportunities are based, you know, here's where their friction points probably are, the use case that they...
That's right. Here's a simple example, right? We just introduced ShareFile for legal. So it's targeted at legal and legal workflows. You know, before you would have to call up a law firm and figure that out. You'd have to navigate. What do you do? Are you divorce law? Are you real estate law? Like, what are you, right?
Yeah.
All the way down to how do you work?
Yeah.
We already know that now, right? Yeah. We know what they're working on. We know what workflows they're using and what they're doing. And we know where we can expand out. So now it becomes, I can have a really smart conversation with my customer and go get them to the right solution and something that adds value to the business.
Yeah. I mean, because I really believe that discovery piece of sales is going to change dramatically because of the technology.
Yeah.
And I think that, like you said, sort of this random walk in the dark, you know, where you're sort of poking around and trying to figure out, you know, who the customer is, what their pain points are. I've got to do all that sort of by having, you know, phone calls with them or pitches with them directly. That literally all goes away. It just goes away. I mean, because your salesperson, and especially if you've got a motion like you do, where they can be on the platform, but even let's say you're out there and you're like, I don't have a freemium type offer. Still, you can get all this information about customers. You can bring it into a model. It can literally, the salesperson can say, hey, I'm going to talk to company ABC about this type of technology. What should I be talking about, right? What are their issues? You know, who are their, it's like it can serve all of that up. And that is going to be incredible. And again, I don't think that that's like 5 years away. Those model capabilities are in play right now. You just got to lean into leveraging them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, if you think back not that long ago, you think back in a deal-based forecast model, what caused my deal to slip? 9 times out of 10, I missed a discovery question. I didn't ask the right question. I didn't know.
I didn't understand.
Yeah, I didn't understand all the pieces. I'm handing all those pieces now to the salesperson. We already know. Right?
Yeah.
So there's far less margin for error there and more opportunity to sell quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. I want to go back to the sort of the data challenge here, because another common frustration I hear from our member companies is they say, look, I have data flying all over the place, but oh my God, it's such a mess and it's siloed and it's some of it's crap or whatever. And so talk a little bit about how you get your data in shape to feed these engines and what that journey was like for you.
Probably the hardest part was that piece, right? And so there was two pieces, getting the data into a usable format that meant something, that told us something, and then getting it into a format where people could consume it. So where I could consume it, my sales leaders could consume it, and we could take an action on it and do something with it. That was the hardest part. And for us, it was a lot of learning, right? We would build what we thought were the right things. And then when you look at it in Tableau, you're like, well, that didn't really tell me what I thought it would, right? Okay. I'm much smarter now, but I guess the advice I would give everybody is that's going to be a learning curve and there's time associated with it. You could probably go out and pay for it, right, with a consulting company, but at the end of the day, it's your data and you got to figure out what you want and what matters to you. So just know that you're not going to stand it up and have it right the first time. It's probably going to take 4 to 6 iterations of it before you look at it in whatever platform, Tableau, Salesforce, whatever, and go, oh, that's actually what I'm looking for. And it tells me what I'm trying to get. And it and I can create or I can figure out what the story is behind the data.
So you as a chief business officer, right, who did you collaborate with in that? Are these IT people? Are these data analysts? I mean, who was sort of your team that got you through those iterations?
Yeah. So there was what I would describe as a bunch of technical work. So that was the IT team. That was our sales operations team. Those were the people touching and manipulating and massaging the actual raw data.
Yeah.
And then it was us. We did use a consulting company, an external party to help us with some of the definitions and what we should look at and what.
And their expertise, was it in, what was their expertise in? I mean, how would you classify that?
Their expertise was in, hey, we've watched these 50 other companies go through this process.
Specifically on this type of data modeling for sales. So that was their expertise. They did. Yeah. Okay, perfect. Yep.
And then it was myself and my direct leadership team to look at it and go, okay, well, yeah, that tells us exactly what we wanted, right? We were asking for X and we got X back. Or wait a minute, we asked for that and that doesn't show what we wanted at all. Because remember, the IT guys, it's very binary, right? You ask for it and they return the data.
Yep.
That's it. They don't know. They don't know the context around it. They don't know really fully what you're after and what problem you're trying to solve. So it was a collaboration between IT, operations, and the sales team.
And I'm just curious sort of how the skills are evolving within, you know, our company. So as you mentioned, you have IT, you have sales ops people. And these are people that know your current technologies, they know Salesforce, et cetera. But now you want to do this next click over of this type of data modeling. You bring in some external expertise to help with that because they've done it before. After you've been doing this for a while, is it to a place where now, you know, like that outside firm was able to help teach you to fish on your own? I mean, do your own, you know, sales ops people and stuff have skills that they didn't have, you know, 6 months or a year ago on this? Were there better data modeling or what's been your experience there?
Yeah, the punchline to this is that we had to go hire a couple of data scientists.
You did. So it's incremental, unique expertise to keep the engine going. Yeah. And I've heard that as well, because I mean, you know, you think about this build, buy type of things. I think in the short term right now for most people, you need to buy some expertise, rent it or whatever, to get you going. And then ultimately, you're going to have to make some investments there and some new skill sets to keep the engines tuned and going. Yeah.
And you know what's really important? So what the data scientists brought to the table is the translation layer, right? Yeah. In sales, we speak a language and we go, okay, well, I want this, right? I want to be able to see what my company
right.
Do. And then that doesn't translate though to an IT person, right? So that data scientist is that translation layer that goes, okay, well, I understand what the business need is and now I can go talk in bits and bytes to the other folks. So
Yeah. No, it is interesting how these skill sets are just evolving before our eyes in terms of what's really super valuable here. I actually want to click back to the freemium to the digital experience. Another common pushback that I hear from member companies around a digital first model is just the belief that customers don't want to buy that way, right? That they want people buy from people, and I don't. No. So, I mean, so what is your perspective on that in terms of, B2B customers are not going to buy, electronically?
They will. So I would say this, right? If you're doing a large strategic deal. And it's what I would call a big bang deal where, hey, the customer's going to buy in August, the customer's going to buy $1 million worth of our software and start implementing it. Yeah, I would agree. They want to talk to somebody. They want to look you in the eye. They want to have a relationship because that's a pretty sizable investment. Mm-hmm. For everything else, I would disagree with that. Our experience has been, we do tens of thousands. We do like 50,000 plus transactions every single month that have an average deal size of less than $2,000. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to talk to us, right? They just want to do it. They want to add users. They want to add a feature, a function. They want to upgrade their tier level, right? We have different tier levels. They want to do stuff. And they don't need or want to talk to a customer. It's no different, Thomas, than if you and I want to buy something from Best Buy or Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's some things I don't need to talk to anybody, and it would actually frustrate me. So there's lots of scenarios, probably way more than you think. And especially as you think about, if you're a sales leader and you think about your expand motion, they're already using it. They're a customer. They know what it does. Hey, Mike, I want to add 10 users or 7 users, or I want to, you know what, for my accountants, I want to upgrade to this new functionality you have. They just want to do that. They don't want to talk to us.
You know, I was just reading this week a book. I think it's called Sales Pitch, because I heard this woman, she's really interesting. I heard another podcast, but it's all about B2B sales. And she said, and let's go with this scenario you just talked about. It's $1 million deal, right? It's a big deal. And the biggest issue she asserts, which I agree with, in B2B sales, from the customer's perspective, is fear. They are afraid that they're going to make the wrong decision.
Yeah.
And if this solution doesn't deliver, they're going to look like an idiot. They're going to lose their job. They're going to be in. And so a big part of getting somebody through the sales cycle is you've got to be alleviating fear, right? And I think so these big dollar values, the way we do that is, again, we throw a lot of people at it because we're trying to convince them, trust us, this is going to be really good. You're going to get a lot of value. We're going to be here for you. I think that the fear level goes down. Again, if you have a model where a customer can try, they start to get some experience, they start to quickly say, look, these guys are definitely can deliver value here. I know it. The fear level is going to go down, 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 and which means the amount of money they're willing to spend is going to go up, up, up. Right. And so if it's still this big bang, you know, we're betting on this new ERP system or CRM system and we're going to gut everything and it's a flash kind of cut thing. Okay, I get that. But for a lot of solutions, it's not that. And if you can create these scenarios where you can dissipate fear by proving, you know, that you can deliver value, I think that that's the game changer there, right? And I'll go back to B2C. When companies like Amazon came out, I mean, we might buy a book, but I was never going to, you know, in the first year of Amazon, if they said, look, you can buy a $500 TV here or $1,000, whatever, I'd have been like, yeah, I don't think so. Right. But now look at where that threshold is. Look at how much money you will spend without even blinking online. You're like, oh, I'm totally confident it's going to get there. And by the way, if it's wrong, something size, wrong color, wrong, it doesn't work, I'll just send it back. We have complete confidence now in that. And so that has made that threshold of what we're willing to spend. That is what's coming to B2B, is that threshold is going to go up and up and up as we demonstrate with confidence that we can deliver value.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the other thing I'll add, and people might wonder, gosh, you guys moved entirely to a vertical model. That's courageous or stupid. I don't know which yet, right? But we believe it was a right move because of what you said, right?
Yeah.
Is it's the fear. And if I can talk to somebody who understands my business and they know the business that I'm in, they're much more likely to assuage those fears and buy in a higher quantity from us because they feel like these guys know what I'm doing for a living.
Absolutely.
They get it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, really understanding the customer by verticalizing you're absolutely right. It's reducing that concern of like, I'm making the wrong investment here. I don't think these guys get me. But yeah, I mean, I think that whole digital threshold of what people will spend is for B2B is definitely gonna change. I'm just kind of curious, as you've been watching these changes, right? And how B2B sales, and you've been doing this for a while. What is, do you think, most different about your job compared to like, you know, 5-10 years ago?
The biggest difference is that deal-based forecast methodology that we used to do versus being data driven now and modeling driven. That's probably the biggest one that sticks out of my head. And then close behind it in second place is the actual go-to-market 10 years ago, 5 years ago even, I don't think it would have been a realistic discussion about having an e-commerce motion where everything at the top of the funnel comes in that way. I think those are probably the two biggest differences.
Yeah. And again, I think that both of those things are coming to every sales organization. I don't care how big and complex you think your enterprise solution is. I think that those are two attributes, which leads to this final question I had for you. So if you were going into sales today, tech sales, B2B, what skills would you focus on? Like, what would you be saying? Look, I really need to be good at this.
So this is a real world example. My son went into tech sales a couple of years ago after I graduated
from college.
Sales. And so this is the advice that I gave him and things that I would share with everybody is, I think there's really four things. Communication mm-hmm. now is more, it's always been important, and communication is a practice, but gosh, it's so, the ability to communicate across functions with different people, it's just so important. Mm-hmm. Collaboration now is so much more important than it's ever been, because we've moved from IT models where the IT department built a solution and they gave it to you, mm-hmm. right? And you kind of had to live with it.
Yeah.
Now, they're not necessarily the buyer in all instances, right? You have the end user and the line of business. So that collaboration between all those groups is so critical. And even internally for us, as you collaborate between IT ops and sales and marketing, it's just so important. So those are the first two. And then less tech, right? When when I came up, it was about the selling
speeds, the feeds and the feature.
It's about the business now, right? And can you articulate and can you talk about the business and what problem that it solves? So that's the third one. The last one I would give everybody is data and the application of data. So you really need to be able to know what data to look for, and then what story does that data tell me, right? What recommendation can I drive from that? So those are the four things that I would share with everybody.
You know, I'm going to put a fifth one on the table, and I have carried quotas in the past, but I am definitely, I came up through the programming side, the IT side. So I'm more on the tech side, not the sales side, right? But my observations with sales organizations, and I'm sure you'll take umbrage with this, but they are typically the last to lean into technology. They are the last. So if you look at it within a tech company and you know, people are using systems, whatever, and the sales folks are over there going, oh, like, how does this thing work again on this piece of, sale? Do I really have to, put this stuff in here? They just, it's not, what they like to do. It's not what they like to do. And they're quite frankly the opposite of data driven, historically. And I'll give you a classic example that, these systems that start to create lead scoring is a great example. If you can use data and analytics to prioritize leads. I've talked to many a company who are like, God, we're like feeding our salespeople these qualified, leads that come from the system, the data, but they're like, I know better, right? Like my gut tells me what I should be. So there haven't been historically data or technology driven. I think that the skills, as a salesperson, I call it sort of a digital native account executive, man, they're going to be leveraging the crap out of both data. They're going to follow the data, like we're talking about, for my renewals, for my expansions, for my leads. And once they're engaging in a sales process, they're going to be using technology all over the place. They're going to be using AI to create their proposals, to do their, like we were talking about earlier, to do their research on the customer. I mean, they're going to be immersed in software capabilities, to make them faster, smarter. And I think that they, if you're in sales, you're going to want to really lean into that, because your productivity is going to be exponential compared to a salesperson who's like, that's not really how I roll. I just think that's going to be a big change.
It's a really great point. It's so interesting to see in sales in my career, there's always been a lot of feel and statements, absolute, right? Like, I feel like this, or the customer won't do this. Well, the data shows completely different stuff, right?
Right.
They might actually do it. An interesting little tidbit that I'll leave you with here is, as we're evolving our sales team. And as new people come into the org, we have a lot of younger folks out of college mm-hmm. or yep. in their early and mid 20s.
Yep.
Boy, there's a real difference.
Difference in profile there.
Very different profile and yep. how they think. They're much more data driven. They're much yep. more technology oriented. So yep. it's interesting to see that, you know, to see the organization kind of evolving as we bring yep. in those that new blood.
Yeah, no, I think this is really an interesting time for go-to-market functions in tech because, and I think I said this to you the first time we talked. I mean, I think for the first time in my career, the sales function for tech companies is actually on the operating table. I mean, like people are looking at it and saying, hey, this model that's been working really, you know, every software company out there is a mini me of Oracle. It's, you know, I mean, in terms of the sales model, yep. it's just like Salesforce is a mini me of Oracle. I'm so, you know, yep. and it's just, that's the model that we've had. And it you know, and you can see the profiles of those salespeople. It has driven a lot of revenue. It's driven a lot of, you know, financial success for sure. But I think, and so CEOs and CFOs are very comfortable with that historical model, right? Like, you know, getting that number done for the quarter, for the year. But I think for the first time ever, it's on the operating table and people are saying, gosh, this model, you know, may need to be different here in you know, as we move forward. And so it's both exciting and I think a little terrifying for sales leaders yeah. right now.
It is. It really is. And, you know, for me and my business, we call them line sizes, right? We have the enterprise, the mid-market, and then mm-hmm. we call this the SMB, right?
Yep.
So one of the things this has really shown, and we've started to reallocate our resources, it doesn't make financial sense for me and operating sense for mm-hmm. me to have people in those lower line sizes down in SMB.
Yep.
They're just too costly. And I can do it all with a digital
remote.
So yep. I'm moving those people up to higher average deal sizes, higher customers. And so, yep. yeah, it completely yep. changes how you run your P&L and think about yep. your sales organization.
Yeah, it does. It's interesting times. Well, I'm watching the clock here, Mike. I really appreciate you coming in. It was a great conversation. And again, I was on the hunt for, you know, what I call an enlightened revenue leader. And we, you know, we had a great conversation. And I think the things you're putting on the table here, I really encourage other revenue leaders to lean into, because I think the game's going to move quickly here. If you're not starting to chip on some of these concepts, I think you're going to find yourself on a very dated go-to-market model in, you know, yeah. a year, 2 years, whatever. So I always close with the question of the day here. And so my question for the audience is, at your company, how innovative is the vision for the future of revenue management? Cheers, everybody.